Hello and welcome once again to What the Flick. It's still a podcast. It's still at my dining room table. But there are three of us today.
Yeah,
indeed there are.
Matt's here. Alonzo's here. My name is Christy. I am here. We are all far from the shallow now. That song will not leave my head. We're going to talk about A Star is Born in all of its various incarnations. But the song from the Bradley Cooper, A Star is Born, which is out this week, is so insanely catchy. I cannot get it out of my head.
It is definitely an earworm. But again, it's No the Man That Got Away.
That is darn good.
But
too.
Almost nothing is.
We'll talk about it. It's No Evergreen.
That too.
So Matt is here, and we're really happy to see you. Happy to have you back.
Yeah,
you
I'm happy to be here. I'm really disappointed that Star is Born was not the story about Ringo Starr.
Boo. Really,
Star is Born.
That's terrible.
That's not even his real name.
Exactly.
A Starkey is Born.
Right. So, Matt, tell us about your new gig.
I am now the general manager of MovieFone.
You have selected.
So here's what's really funny about that is that for decades, my voicemail on my phone is basically, hello and welcome to Matt Atchity's voicemail. If you would like to leave a message, please wait for the tone. And I would get calls from time to time over the years while I was at Rotten Tomatoes from Russ Leatherman, Mr. Movie Phone.
The voice.
Oh, the voice. And he'd be like, yeah, okay, that's cute.
Who has a great voice cameo in Josie and the Pussycats, by the way.
Oh, does he really?
Yes.
So I just started. This is week three, and I'm very excited. I'm working with Phil and Drew and Tony, the guys over there. Drew, you've probably run into, and Phil Perello, who I worked with years and years and years ago when Rotten Tomatoes was part of IGN, and he had come on as the features editor there. Great team. They've kept it running, and we're going to put some gas back in the tank, and it's going to be awesome.
Now, so what is MoviePass's, like, hey, we're still here, we're viable?
MoviePhone.
Right, but doesn't MoviePass own?
Yes, so MoviePass owns MoviePhone. It's a division of MoviePass, but
right.
It's, you know, MoviePhone's its own business, and, you know, I get to come in and kind of like, here's what we're going to do. It's,
cool.
it's an ad-based business right now, like Rotten Tomatoes was. There's still the listings up. I'm not going to lay out all my plans quite yet. I'm
not
still
to you
putting
people.
It together. Right, exactly. Not to you, Alonzo. Christy, I might tell, but not Bob. No, it's going to be great. You know, one of the things I'm really excited about is, when I came into Rotten Tomatoes, there was a really strong core of people there, but nobody really, like, at that point when I came in, it was what, 11 years ago? Like, the public awareness of Rotten Tomatoes was not huge, and so there was a lot of work that the team and I did to really grow it. Well, everybody's at least heard of MoviePhone, so the recognition there, like, that's a great place to start, and there's still a really solid audience there. So people are like, oh, what is MoviePhone still doing? Well, there's a website that's got a fair amount of traffic, and you can still get listings for movies.
Cool.
And times and showtimes, even though, you know, ticketing isn't exactly what it used to be. So there's a lot of stuff that I'm looking at doing. You know, again, a great team. We're going to build out the team. And I initially was thinking, like, do I start saying we're going to make MoviePhone great again?
Oh,
right.
Please don't.
Too soon.
And the thing is, I'm not going to say that because that would imply that the guys who have been there are not doing great work.
Right.
And they are doing great work. They've had a lot of challenges for the last couple of years and, you know, been missing resources over the years. And what I'm excited about is be able to come in and help them get the resources and bring in some new stuff and set some direction and collaborate, you know, similar to what the team and I were doing at Rotten Tomatoes.
Cool.
You know, just looking forward. And also, it's awesome to be covering movies because the last year of covering politics at Young Turks, like, I love the guys at Young Turks, but covering politics is the worst thing in the world.
It is draining.
It's hard to get out of bed for.
It sucks.
Well, we're so glad that you're doing it, and we're so glad that you still have time to hang out with us in whatever form.
Make time. I'm the general manager.
That's true.
I get to make whatever time.
We appreciate you making time for us, and I know you've got a call in 20 minutes, so we're going to talk about the stuff that we can talk about with you while you are here.
Here's the last thing I want to say. So as somebody who is at the general manager level, I now get to be drunk with power, not just drunk with my ties.
Because you're multitasking.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about
power Mai Tais.
Speaking of being drunk and powerful, let's talk about A Star is Born.
Oh, I thought we were talking about Venom.
Yes. So Alonzo, you should describe this, since you are the expert here on all things Star Is Born.
Sure. So in this version, Bradley Cooper, who also makes his debut as director and is also credited as a co-writer, plays roots rocker Jackson Maine, who is super popular but is kind of on the decline. He's losing his hearing. He definitely has substance abuse issues. And one night after a concert, he needs to go to a bar, any bar, and he happens to wander into a drag bar where one of the performers is Allie, played by Lady Gaga. She's the one performer there who doesn't lip sync, who sings her own stuff, or who sings for herself, rather.
Also seems to be the only one that's cisgendered there, maybe?
That also, yes, as far as we know. And so she does a torchy rendition of La Vie en Rose, blows him away. They spend the evening together. He finds out that she's a songwriter, but that she has been discouraged because she doesn't have the looks. The people keep telling her she doesn't have the looks to be a singer on her own. The next night, he gets her to come to one of his concerts and drags her on stage to sing a song that they had started working on together. And what do you know? A Star Is Born.
Yes, hence the name.
Quick point of clarification. Are there non-torchy versions of La Vie en Rose?
Well, I mean, there's a Grace Jones one that's a little more, you know, upbeat.
This is very, like, you know, va-va-voomy.
Very, very Edith Piaf.
Very va-va-gaga.
Yeah.
So I love this movie. It is enormously entertaining. It does exactly what you want it to. It is dreamy and romantic and passionate. It is shot beautifully. Bradley Cooper chose well in Matthew Libatique as his DP.
One of the two movies, as you mentioned, he's not releasing this
movie. He also shot Venom, which we'll talk about. But Gaga is a star, and I love the fact that we see her stripped down. I mean, you think of Lady Gaga, you think of all the really dramatic ways in which she's reinvented herself over the years and the masks that she's worn and the character she has put on for us. You do truly feel like you are seeing her. He is truly seeing her, and we feel like we are as well.
Yeah.
And so it's a massive discovery to see somebody who's been a massive part of pop culture for the last decade in fresh eyes.
Yeah.
Bradley Cooper has the chops. My God. We were all laughing at the trailer when it was like, from director Bradley Cooper. But it is so beautifully crafted, and it's over 2 hours, and it moves so well.
I mean, it's not like, the filmmaking blows me away. But as far as, like, craftsmanship, as far as, like, this is the kind of movie that studios are supposed to just turn out on a regular basis, and so rarely do. And if it were easy, they would, and they don't. I mean, he doesn't imbue it with a ton of style, but he makes this thing work, and that in itself is an indicator that he knows what he's doing as a filmmaker, or at least has surrounded himself with the right DP, the right editor, all these people to sort of bring all this about.
And I think he's clearly been paying attention to the people he's worked with, right? And I was very impressed with maybe not quite as much as you guys were, but, you know, and there's a couple little things that bothered me about the movie, but for the most part, I think that this is a terrific debut. Some of the stuff I found really intriguing was that his use of close-ups in so many places initially threw me off a little bit, but then it tilted towards making especially these big concert scenes feel very intimate. Mm-hmm. And I felt very immersed in kind of the relationship that he would have on stage, that Jack and Allie had on stage. I was really impressed with that. You know, I would have liked to have seen maybe a little bit more between him and Sam Elliott. Like, I felt like, I mentioned this, I think, to you after the movie, I felt like there were maybe 3 or 4 pages out of the script that were lost. You
with know, like, Sam Elliott as his brother, his much older brother, who's also like his tour manager, I want to say.
A little bit of that, a little bit of like the, you know, it's not just the hearing problem. He's got tinnitus, and which is a different thing than hearing loss.
Right.
And the movie, I think there was an opportunity to maybe get into a little bit of how debilitating that can be. But that's fine. But what I do want to say is I was floored by Gaga in this. Yeah. I was really, really impressed. And as much as like that New Yorker article goes into that you were talking about, Christy, that goes into Bradley Cooper and like...
That was the New York Times.
I'm sorry, the New York Times article and like his treaty, you know, you could look at this as like his kind of take on the fame machine and, you know, kind of as you mentioned before we start recording, art versus commerce. I actually am fascinated about how this story... at least the evolution of the artist really maps to Gaga, because she started out as this like singer-songwriter type, right? And she just wasn't getting anywhere. And I mean, in very broad strokes, it wasn't until she really like glammed things up that she really became who we know.
Right. And while the Bradley Cooper character tries to sort of judge her for taking a pop turn, the movie doesn't. The movie is basically saying like, this is in her paint box. This is what she wants to do. This is how she wants to express herself. He can't deal with it because it's not what he does.
It's not his dream for her.
Exactly. It's not what he nurtured her or thought that he was nurturing her to be. And but they do delineate the fact that it's the character's problem and not the movie saying, oh, she's sold out because now she's a pop singer.
She's having fun. Like in the choreography sessions, like she's not rolling her eyes at it. She's having she makes a point of saying she chose her hair color. When she dyes her hair kind of an orangey platinum kind of, she chooses the color for herself. But yeah, she's having a good time going on SNL, being famous, being loved.
And some of the tragedy of the movie, and look, like, it's not some huge spoiler if you know the old movies, and I'm not going to give anything away, but the big tragedy is that he does start to turn the corner and really does try and go along and accept her artistic path, right? Like, they have the big blow up, but then he tries to turn that around and look at it differently than he would have done.
Yeah, and he famously, you know, he's really good in this too. I mean, he taught himself to play the guitar and play the piano.
And apparently he worked with a coach to make himself sound like Sam Elliott.
He lowered his voice.
Which at first I thought was this really bizarre choice until I realized they make it clear that it's a plot point that he sounds like Sam Elliott.
And it seems kind of mannered at first, but he worked to lower his voice by an entire octave. And yeah, we're not hearing Rocket Raccoon in there at all.
No.
It's a whole different persona he's put on. It's very believable.
But you bring up the plot point, and I thought that was a weird choice that, like, I would have bought, you know, when they have, there's a line about, you know, stealing the voice, and I would have thought, okay, I get that these two are brothers and they sound alike, but I was like, is the stealing the voice about the singing? Is it about the way it, like, it just was a weird...
Well, I think they wrap that up at the end. I don't want to give that away, but I think there's a scene that does kind of put a button on that.
We should talk about where this falls in the pantheon of Star is Borns.
So this is the fourth movie called A Star is Born. It's the fifth version of this story, if you count an early 30s movie called What Price Hollywood, that George Cukor directed, which is about an actress who is, she's a waitress at the Brown Derby. She's discovered by a director, and as her star rises, his falls. Cukor was, in fact, approached to direct the original A Star is Born, but he thought that it was too similar. In fact, it was almost a lawsuit about the first A Star is Born being too similar to What Price Hollywood. So then the first Star is Born is Janet Gaynor and Frederick March, and it's set in the world of the movies. The 1954 A Star is Born with Judy Garland and James Mason is set in the world of film also, but is a musical, and she is a singer.
And it is George Cukor.
And it is George Cukor. He did finally step up to do that one. Then they abandon Hollywood and just go straight to the music world for the 76 Barbara Streisand, Kris Kristofferson version, which is where this one also lies.
Right. And there are pieces... It's very much its own contemporary thing.
Yes. It feels modern for a warhorse.
But there are pieces which are clear, sweet little homages to the previous ones.
Yes.
So, like, for example, the drag club that he discovers her at is called the Blue Blue, which is the name of the after-hours club where Judy Garland is singing. Where James Mason discovers her.
Well, and the whole, like... Hey, I just wanted to take another look at you.
Yeah, is in all of them in some form.
Is in all of them. And in fact, even in What Price Hollywood, there's a moment where he says, I just wanted to hear your voice again.
Yeah, so there are certain beats it hits, like how he meets her, the hey, I just wanted to take another look at you moment. Mm-hmm.
The
discovery of her.
Yeah, the public humiliation.
Yes, there is that.
Which is handled differently in various places.
That scene was horrifying.
Yeah.
That scene, that was, I think, one of the most emotional scenes in the movie for me. Like, I just was, it was one of the most, again, like, horrific scenes to watch unfold in a drama that I've seen in a long time.
Well, he's so shattered. He's just as primal how broken he is.
And I think this movie is smarter than the other ones about how it handles addiction and the way people respond to it. I think that I think Allie is maybe the least sort of enabling of the women in these movies dealing with the alcoholic partner. It's very smart about how it handles so much of this stuff. It's some interesting choices here, though. Like the previous versions, the up and coming ingenue is played by the more established screen performer.
Right, they've all been around for a little while. Yeah. Right, and so like and Judy Garland and Barbara Streisand and
Janet
Gaga
Gaynor.
And Gaga also all like allude to that in that they say, you know, I've worked hard for this for a long time.
Right,
Janet Gaynor is more of like fresh off the bus, whatever kind of.
But I'm saying, but real life Janet Gaynor was a movie star much longer than Frederick March had, and you know, Streisand was more famous than Christofferson. Judy Garland was more famous than James Mason. And in this one, it's a little more equal in that, like, you know, they're closer to the same age. Obviously, Bradley Cooper is much more established as a film person than she is, which is a reversal. But then at the same time, obviously, she's a mega celebrity on a level that he isn't, even though they're both super famous.
Right. And the women who are in them are so singular as performers of their time. Like, no one was like Judy Garland, no one's like Barbara Streisand, and no one is like Gaga, in that they are singular, but they all have an unusual beauty to them, which the film remarks on.
Yeah, the whole, like, when he, you know, the removal of the makeup, that's right out of the 54 version, you know.
The nose
version that you would think is just out of Streisand, but no, it comes up in the Garland one as well, actually. And even, there's even a scene in the first A Star Is Born, in the Janet Gaynor one, where like the studio makeup people don't know what to do with her, and like they're giving her the Crawford smear on her lips and stuff.
I just went back and watched the Janet Gaynor and the Judy Garland ones. So they're fresh.
The two other quick things I want to mention is one, you know, maybe my complaint about Sam Elliott in this is that there's not enough of him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you always want to see more of him, and he's, you know, there's a scene, you know, like one of the final scenes between Cooper and he is just like, there's almost no dialogue, and yet these guys just make it work, and it's devastating. And then also pleasantly surprised by Andrew Dice Clay in this.
Yeah, he was good. And Dave Chappelle, not enough Dave Chappelle.
Enough Dave Chappelle. But like that's another piece where I feel like there were pages of the script. Like he shows up and like, okay, wait a minute. What's going on? Where does this come from?
I want to give a shout out to Willem Belli.
Willem, he's so funny.
RuPaul's Drag Race, who took a role that could have just easily been like drag queen number two, and like steals every second he's on screen. Flirts madly with Bradley Cooper. Like it's a treat to watch.
Blonde one?
Yes.
Yeah, that was good.
Willem did these really funny clips for the city of West Hollywood called the WeHoans, kind of like the Californians.
It's
like a direction thing. Anyway, go look up the WeHoans. Anyway, we got to move on to Venom, but what are your numbers, friends? I'm saying 8.9.
I said 9.
I'm saying 8. Okay. Yeah, still really great though.
Okay, our number is 8.6.
Yeah,
it's 94%. And go see it with great sound if you can.
Yes.
I saw it at the Dolby screening room in Burbank with like a million speakers, and it's overwhelming.
And they also showed it at the AMC Century City, and like there's that one big house upstairs with the really fancy sound and the comfy seats. It sounded amazing, although Dave, who has like, you know, hearing issues, it was almost too loud for him at a few points.
That's at the AMC I was at. It was almost too loud. Like it was, but I think partly it's the AMC that I saw it at. Like, they're such terrible projectionists anyway.
You can't block out the power of Gaga.
You see it with as good a sound as you can.
All right. So it's great. Okay. So Venom, not so great. Matt, tell us what Venom's about.
All right. So Venom is based on the comic book character. Eddie Brock is this reporter who had been run out of New York and now works in San Francisco. And he has this catastrophic screw up in his career and his personal life, and ends up with an alien symbiote that bonds to him, and together they are Venom, and the symbiote has a taste for human heads.
It's like a super violent version of All of Me.
Exactly.
Right.
I said that in my review.
That's what I was thinking too. But that's like the good part of it. The comic parts of it work. When it's sillier, it seems it's stronger for me.
Yeah. So look,
when it's playful.
This movie's a bit of a mess. Absolutely. I like this a lot more than you guys did. I think that this was fun. Part of it's the expectations. I went into this expecting something just god awful, and I thought they kind of pulled it off. didn't really think there was great chemistry between Hardy and Michelle Williams.
There's none.
I liked Hardy playing this role. I think he was pretty solid. And really what the gem of the movie really is when the symbiote and Hardy are talking to each other and arguing, like that's the best parts of this because it's like this really twisted buddy picture. Right. And that's what I liked about it. There's a bunch of stuff that it's like, but the argument that happens that basically Tom Hardy is having with himself, I thought was funny. And that to me makes the movie worth it. It's not great, but, and I know people are going to like hardcore Venom fans are going to be upset that this is not an R-rated movie. I think it doesn't suffer from not being an R-rated movie.
I think it does because I think the movie wants to have all this like stabbing and beheading and heads being bitten off without a drop of blood. And that drives me up the wall.
There's massive carnage in this movie.
Yeah, but it,
and
it,
no blood. Yeah,
no, and yeah, and so it's like watching those PG-13 horror slasher movies where people get stabbed but don't bleed. It just took me out of it. I didn't have
A quick note to the nerds: do not misinterpret when Christy says there is massive carnage in this movie. That means something.
Not the character.
No, sorry, no, but a lot of people die.
Yeah, I did not have high hopes because you know the all media was at 4 o'clock on a Tuesday and the embargo lifted at 7 o'clock on a Tuesday and it was like, okay, well, that's...
But it's better than the embargo being on opening day.
True. I was stunned at how terrible this was. Like, this is,
I didn't think it was that terrible.
I was never entertained. I was bored out of my mind. It is so choppy and nonsensical, and characters do a 180 without any explanation. Venom goes from wanting to take over the world to like, no, I've decided I'm going to stay. I like it here. I'm going to help you beat the other, you know, wad of chewing gum that's now inside of Riz Ahmed, you know. They make a whole thing about how, like, the alien symbiotes, even on a host that's compatible, kills them. You know, it deteriorates their liver. They tell Eddie at one point, your heart is atrophying. And then, nope, that stops. Yeah, that ends. That's not a thing anymore. Everything's great. It just stuff like that. It's like what, you talk about there being 4 pages missing from A Star.
There's like 4 chapters. Right. Half this script is gone.
Yeah. I just thought this was a fiasco. And as much as I love Tom Hardy, I didn't buy this character, this like motorcycle riding investigative reporter who does local San Francisco stories, but is on a network.
I figured it was like an online thing. I figured it wasn't actually on television because that would seem kind of archaic, but he was on some kind of like online network.
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
I just didn't buy it.
No one buys it. So yeah, I am also like you, Alonzo. I'm a giant fan of Tom Hardy, and he is notorious for absolutely giving his all to any role, you know, physically, emotionally. And I appreciated that he went for it here physically. He's giving it his all. That first fight scene when the henchmen enter his shabby little apartment to try to get the black goo out of him, and he's discovering for the first time the true extent of his abilities. Like, that scene's fun. Like, he's getting yanked hither and yon, and he's panicking, but he's also, like, excited about his power, and that is a good example of him going for it. But also in that scene, you can see what is happening, and increasingly as the set pieces get larger, because they're at night, because Venom is essentially just a giant muscular dominatrix in head-to-toe latex, and he's fighting another creature which looks a lot like him, you cannot see who's doing what to whom. And then there's one big fight where you can also kind of ascertain the people inside of the creatures. It's just, again, Matthew Libatique also shot this. I don't know what happened with this because he is a genius. He's Darren Aronofsky's usual DP. He shot A Star Is Born. You cannot see shit at night.
You mentioned the dominatrix thing. I saw a tweet that said the best way to describe Venom is that a Vice reporter screws up his career, goes on a bender, and gets a new dom.
Right. I figured he'd work for something like Vice. I didn't think it was actual television.
So somebody, like Glenn Weldon, said, I'm preparing for Venom by putting 6 black and white cookies in the microwave, smearing them on my face, and then covering my torso in magic shell. That fight scene at the end is nonsensical. In my review of The Wrap, I said that it was like if Michael Bay directed 2 wads of phlegm having a fight after he just went to a Jackson Pollock exhibition. I had no idea what was going on.
It is totally inscrutable along the lines of a Transformers movie. Right. Or an early Transformers movie.
Oh, you're going to hate the sequel then.
The
second they hint at. they hint at.
Yeah, which, so. But, you know, I can only hope this does badly enough that we'll never have to see it.
I don't know, though. I mean, isn't it part of a larger world? He's a Spider-Man villain, right? So don't we have to see him again in some form?
But it's not part of the MCU.
Right.
As people on the internet were so kind and generous to point out to me in the friendliest way possible that this is not technically a Marvel Studios movie, even though the flap Marvel logo appears at the beginning.
It says in association.
Exactly. Right. Like, it's like an X-Men.
But here's the thing. Like, that stuff is so stupid. Like, people who get caught up in that continuity. It's not part of the Marvel Universe until somebody at Disney decides, yeah, you know what, we're going to bring Venom into our movies. And it's be like, yeah, F everybody, bitches.
Because Spider-Man now is, so it's like, anyway.
I want to mention really fast, I like Jenny Slate in this.
She's terrible.
No, but she's so cute. No, you have some unexpected casting here. People who don't usually do the big superhero movies, like Michelle Williams, like Riz Ahmed, like Jenny Slate. Yeah. She's adorable.
But she's bad. Riz Ahmed is bad. Like, and I love both of them. In my review, I said, like, this is maybe their first bad performance.
Yeah, maybe the only one that's really outside of Hardy cast well is what's his name who plays the doctor from
the guy from Veep.
The guy from Veep.
Reed Scott.
Reed Scott. Yeah, Reed Scott's like the only one who's really appropriately cast in anything else in any other role in this movie.
Okay, so what are your numbers then?
I said 1.5. I hated this movie.
I gave it a 6. I thought it was worth seeing. And I liked it even kind of sober.
It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so I guess you could have been day drinking.
Listen, after a couple of margaritas, this movie would be a 10.
You could have been pre-partying. I gave it a 5. Again, I like Tom Hardy. I laughed here and there.
How did Nick like it?
Nick liked it okay.
All right.
But it is super violent. I mean, really, right at the edge of what you can get away with in a PG-13 movie. So if you're thinking about taking kids, was it ever supposed to be R? Was it originally R and they dialed it back? Or is it just the expectation was based on the character that it should be R?
It doesn't look like it was something that they shot to be R. Like, it doesn't look like...
It's not like Night School where they dub over lines and stuff.
Right. It doesn't look like they shot... It looked like they went out... I mean, I have to imagine that they went for PG-13. Like, I just...
They should have gone full Logan on this. It might have made it better.
Yeah. I think I read an interview with Ruben Fleischer, who's the director, who also did Zombieland and Gangster Squad. Yeah, not great, but that he wanted this to be as family friendly as possible, but it's not. It's like the stuff of nightmares if you're a little bitty kid. Venom's teeth are super sharp, and his face is really scary, and
all that tongue and the drool and everything.
And the idea of a possession, he's like possessed essentially. Anyway, it's 11 o'clock. Do you have to go?
I do have to go. Actually, I have a call to get on. This is the life of the guy in charge.
You have a movie phone call.
Yeah, exactly.
Hello.
If you'd like to talk to me now, press 1.
You have selected whore. That was a real thing. The Ken Russell movie in the early 90s.
Anyway, so Matt has to go.
All right. You've selected A Star is Born. I want to see A Star is Born Legacy.
A
Star is Born Identity.
Boo.
Get out.
We're going to continue talking about movies as Matt gathers his things.
Yes, I'm going to gather my things.
Hopefully we'll see you next week again.
Yes.
Excellent. Always a pleasure, sir.
Yes, and we are working on things.
We are.
Right.
We are working on things.
Working on things and stuff.
Things are being worked on. Right. So continue going. Yeah.
You want to pause or are we just going to keep going? All right, we're just going to...
Well, hold on. That's my mic. Oh.
Don't pod down, Christy.
Yeah, good. There I am. Okay, so I can hear myself now.
All right.
Bye.
Toodaloo.
No, it's because I'm going and no one else is working.
People have things to say.
Peace out.
Besides us. So let's move on to The Hate U Give.
Yes.
Alonzo, do you want to describe that?
I'll take a crack at it. Right. Sure. Amanda Stenberg stars as a young woman who... do you know the term code switching?
Yes.
So she does a lot of code switching because she attends a sort of snooty white prep school and sort of has one identity that she conveys there. But then she lives with her family in a working class black neighborhood. And her two worlds collide when she goes to a party, runs into a childhood friend of hers who is now works for the sort of neighborhood drug kingpin, and they get pulled over by the cops, and her friend gets shot, and she's the only witness, and so is sort of torn between what she's supposed to do about it and the sort of larger system that exists to exonerate cops in situations like this. And this movie feels super relevant and super of the now. The very first scene is her parents explaining to the kids when they're relatively young, like 12, 13 years old, when you get pulled over by the police, you put your hands on the dashboard right. and you spread your fingers out and you answer his questions and you do not make trouble and you do not do anything at all that might lead to you getting shot, because there is a very good possibility that you will get shot.
Yes, and it's known as the talk. At what age do black parents give their kids the talk?
Exactly.
Yes.
And it informs the rest.
Just interrupt and say, goodbye, I'm going to movie phone.
Bye.
And it informs the rest of the film. Like, it's a teen movie. It's based on a YA novel, and so there's, like, you know, stolen kisses and proms and all that stuff, but you're always in the back of your mind, there's that knot in your stomach about, oh God, when are things going to get terrible? And that knot, I think, is, you know, obviously for viewers is a very pale, removed version, but, you know, so many people have talked about, to be black in America is to have walking PTSD, to constantly be on your guard, to constantly be on your alert. And this movie just really got to me. The ending doesn't entirely work, but otherwise, it was an emotional experience. It's incredibly well acted by this really strong ensemble, including the great Regina Hall. I just think it. Dave and I were talking about it afterwards, and I think it's going to be kind of like the way that Brokeback Mountain was for gay audiences, where it didn't necessarily tell us anything we didn't know, but it was very powerful to see that story conveyed and to know that non-gay audiences were going to be emotionally swept up in this story and maybe even realizing that they are part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I think that's what this movie is going to be like, that black audiences are going to see it and recognize an America they know and, you know, we'll be glad to see this tale writ large, and I think white audiences are going to be moved by it and are also going to have to think about their complicity in making the world the way it is as presented in this film.
Yeah, there have been a lot of movies in the last year or so that have taken on this topic from various perspectives. We had Blindspotting earlier this year.
Fruitvale Station.
Right. Just last week we had Monsters and Men,
right,
which is about a police shooting kind of from three different perspectives.
Right.
And we had Whose Street, the documentary about
yes.
Ferguson last year. So we're getting at this over and over again from various angles, and yet it is so smart to do it. And this is based on a novel by, I want to get her name, the writer is, hang on, Angie Thomas wrote the novel this is based on. But yeah, this is so informative and so helpful, as you say, to let young people know, like, we see you, we hear you, we understand your concerns and about the world in which you live, but also, yeah, to inform others who are not, you know, young black kids, okay, this is how you can be helpful. And there are white characters in this
yes.
who deal with her and her suffering in various ways that aren't necessarily always helpful, but I don't know that the movie necessarily judges them for their bad choices. I mean,
yeah.
there's a best friend who is kind of ignorant, who
yes.
thinks she's well-meaning,
yeah.
right. She thinks she's saying and doing the right things, but she's really not. There's a boyfriend played by
KJ Apa
yes,
of
from Riverdale
with
yes.
another weird dye job on his hair.
Yes, and so he again, wants to do all the right things.
He actually
yeah.
says, I don't see color at one point, but the movie realizes how ridiculous that is, it doesn't entirely judge him for that and allows him a certain level of redemption. And the thing is, this sounds like Broccoli. This sounds
it's
like a social issue movie, but it's a really moving film. Like, the characters are really strong. The Stenberg's performance is really powerful. I cared about these people. They don't just sort of represent, you know, issues and topics and whatever. Like, these are really great characters, and this is a really powerfully assembled film. I really want people to see it.
Yeah, you can feel her anxiety even before the shooting happens. And I want to mention Al G. Smith is the young actor who plays Khalil, her childhood friend, who gets shot in front of her. Even before that happens, there's a sort of a simmering tension here because her existence is, you know, kind of fraught. She can't always be who she wants to be. She's got this identity crisis. You know, she's not always truthfully 100% herself in either situation.
Exactly.
And you feel that. Regina Hall as her mom is, you know, great as always. And
Russell Hornsby as her dad.
He's so good.
Yeah.
And you understand where everyone is coming from here. And yes, and it is romantic and it is dramatic and it is sweet at times and it is tense at times. It's really well made and it it builds to its climax in a way that makes that, and it's too bad Matt's not here to hear the word, it's earned. When she reaches, you know, her epiphany,
yes,
her climax, it absolutely is an emotional, you know, swelling that you feel caught up in as well. This is directed by George Tillman Jr.,
yes,
who's got kind of a random cross-section of films he has made. Notorious was pretty good.
All right.
The Notorious B.I.G. movie. The Longest Ride, which was kind of just pretty and soapy with Scott Eastwood. And Men of Honor.
Oh, boy.
With Cuba Gooding Jr., right?
Yeah.
He's a
Navy
guy. Anyway, yeah. So there's a random cross-section of films that he has made, but this is definitely his best and very much worth seeing.
And Soul Food.
Soul Food was good.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm saying 8.5. This is a really good, solid, well-made movie.
9.2. I think this is a really dynamite movie, and I want it to become a topic of conversation. And again, it's not just what it's about and what it says, but how it says it and the story that it tells.
Yeah, Amon Lestenberg is a star. So our number is 8.9. Is it 95% on the tomato meter? Yeah, she was in a movie also based on a YA novel last year called
Everything,
where she is trapped indoors with some teen girl disease.
She's the girl in the plastic bubble. Right?
Yeah.
I didn't see it. Was it good?
Yeah. I think for its target audience,
okay,
it is. Yeah. It's like romantic and sweet and tragic. And
fair enough.
Yeah. But she's just got a really lovely, natural way about her. Just like a great charisma about her. So I liked that a lot. What else? So there's a couple different documentaries we're going to talk about. Unfortunately, I have not seen Alonzo's and Alonzo has not seen mine,
right,
but I want to get to them because they both matter in different ways. The first one we're going to talk about is called Free Solo. And it is not about getting Han out of carbonite.
Or red plastic cups.
Yes. So I had the pleasure of spending quite a bit of time with the guy that Free Solo is about. His name is Alex Honnold.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the first person and the only person still ever to free solo climb up the face of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park.
Explain what free solo means.
Okay, so he is climbing without ropes, without any kind of safety equipment.
Wow.
Just his hands and his feet. El Capitan is notoriously difficult and is a mecca for climbers, and it's like 3,000 feet up. And he had climbed it many times with ropes. Even with ropes, it's hard. Even with ropes, it takes a really long time, and you have to, you know, be with other climbers and really know what you're doing. Alex is long and lanky, and he's got big hands, and he's gotten really good over the years at free soloing, which is just you're just climbing, and there is nothing to stop you if you fall. If you let go, you're dead.
He's Tom Cruising.
Yeah, totally. But this is real. And so the movie was made by a fellow climber, Jimmy Chin, and his wife, Chai Vassarelli, I want to say is how you say her last name. And Jimmy Chin's a longtime climber and a longtime friend of Alex Honnold. And wanted to just make a movie about him. And he's like, okay, well, if we're going to make a movie about me, let's make a movie about me trying to free solo up El Capitan. And there are a lot of conversations within the film about the anxiety the filmmakers have about potentially documenting their good friend plummeting to his death.
Right.
You know, and we're there for it, and we can't stop it.
Yeah.
And is it exploitative of us if we are a part of this? It is beautifully shot. I did a couple of Q&As with him that took place at the Cinerama Dome.
Mm-hmm.
And really, if you can find a place like that to see it, you should. It was only playing on a few screens over the weekend, four screens. It was like one in New York, one in LA, one in Denver, one in Boulder. And it had the highest per screen average ever for a documentary.
Mm.
It made $75,000 on each of those screens.
Mm.
I did five Q&As with Alex and a couple with him and his girlfriend, Sonny McCandless, who is a big part of the film as well. And we had absolutely sold out screenings. We had standing ovations every single time. He's 33 years old.
Mm.
And you see him go through the process of like meticulously mapping every single place he needs to put a foot or put a hand. And sometimes there's just like the ittiest, bittiest bit of a place for him to put his thumb. And then he has like one thumb, and then he crosses over and puts another thumb somewhere else. And it is both intimate in the way it shot because they put a bunch of remote cameras all over.
I was going to say, where were they?
So there's one attempt that he makes to climb it, and he gets like part of the way up and just feels like, I can't do this. Like the fact that I can see and I can feel all these people around me watching me, I cannot do this. And then they come back 6 months later and they rethink their game plan. And so you have some cameras that are remotely placed along the route. Mm-hmm. And everybody who shot it is also a climber. Mm-hmm. And then you have some people who have rappelled down and are like waiting. And then you have some people who are shooting it from the ground all the way up. And they try to make themselves as unobtrusive as possible. Gotcha. To allow him to make this trek optimally and not, you know, God forbid, like sneeze or get in the way or sure. distract him. So, spoiler alert, he makes it, but it's just fucking stressful. It is, if you are afraid of heights, even being in an elevator, because there are some points where he's just like crammed in between a couple of like really tight spaces. There's a whole section where it's just like a vertical crack, like a 90-degree vertical crack. It is breathtakingly beautiful and so dramatic and so stressful.
Wow.
I had so much fun talking to him and his girlfriend. He's got a really like dry, off-kilter sense of humor. He's brilliant. Mm. He's absolutely brilliant, but he's really meticulous about his planning. And yet with these Q&As I did with him, we started out doing them in chairs. And then by like the third one, he goes, can we just do it standing? Like he wanted it to feel free. He wanted to feel unencumbered by anything himself within this setting too. And he's really quick on his feet. He's a trip. Mm. He lived in this van for like 9 months. I'm sorry, nine years rather.
Whoa.
This tricked out van where it had like a bed and it had a kitchen, and he would, you know, make food for himself on the pan and then just like eat it from a spatula from the pan. And, and then he met this girlfriend, Sani, who, you know, understands his dreams, but also wants to be an emotional factor in his life when he's thinking about whether or not he wants to put himself in these potentially perilous mm-hmm. situations. And so that dynamic is interesting. And she is like effervescent and adorable. And she's got this light about her, and she is like a nice contrast with him because he's really like dry and low key and he's kind of all business. But I really recommend seeing this. It's inspiring. It's thrilling. It's tense. It's beautifully made. I can imagine it being shortlisted for the documentary Oscar. Yeah. Go.
Okay.
It's opening wider in this week and in forthcoming weeks. So yeah, definitely see it on a big screen. You can hear his breath. You can hear like birds buzzing his head while he's trying to do it. It's really, really cool.
It kind of sounds like, did you ever see that documentary, The Other Shore, about Diane and Ayad's attempt to swim from Cuba to Miami?
No.
Which is like through jellyfish infested waters and just all these things. And she was already in her 60s. There's sort of the same thing where it's like, are we documenting this woman drowning? You know, but, you know, spoiler, she finally makes it.
And
it's an extraordinary film.
Yes. I'm saying 9 on it. It's at 100, it's at 100% on the tomato meter right now.
Okay.
And I really recommend seeing it when it comes to your town. So cool. Free Solo, it is called.
Cool. Also opening this weekend is Studio 54, which is from Matt Tiernauer, who previously this year gave us Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood. And this is basically a sort of history of the legendary New York Dance Club and its moment. A very brief moment, as it turns out. But, you know, we think of it as having this enormous cultural impact, but it really was only around for a couple of years.
Well, you can say the word Studio 54, and it conjures immediate images of, like, a look and a vibe.
Yes.
and a debaucherousness.
Yeah, a way of dressing everything, you know. And what's interesting about the film is that Ian Schrager, who started mm-hmm. it with Steve Rubell, has generally been fairly tight-lipped about it over the years. You know, Steve Rubell died. Schrager has become a very successful hotel magnate. But he sat down with Tiernauer and did these interviewers. And you know, Tiernauer was a journalist at Vanity Fair for years and, you know, kind of, you know, grew up in Beverly Hills. There's a really good interview with him on the Bret Easton Ellis podcast. They have very similar backgrounds. Tiernauer's father was a producer on, like, Murder, She Wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so he's good at kind of these larger than life personalities and getting them to talk about stuff, and so it's this really fascinating glimpse behind, you know, the many curtains of Studio 54 and what was going on and how they put it together and why it took off. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of different stories to tell, the individual people and the sort of cultural impact of the music and that kind of thing. And the, you know, some people may walk away that it's not, it doesn't tell them exactly what they wanted to know. But I think the story that it does tell is a really interesting one. There's really amazing footage. Yeah, and in fact, actually, one of the people who winds up being a key player once the Studio 54 guys start dealing with a lot of legal problems because of their, like, tax returns and the drugs and whatnot.
I was going to say there's massive drug use going on there and, like, sex everywhere, right?
Yes, yes, but that wasn't so much. They didn't get arrested for that. They got arrested for tax stuff. Roy Cohn was Steve Rubell's lawyer, and in fact, actually, was such an interesting figure in this that Tiernauer's next movie is about Roy Cohn.
Oh.
Because obviously Cohn was also a mentor of the president's, so he's re-entered the news of late as a kind of a historical figure. So yeah, this is, I think, a really fun film. And, you know, it's, you know, like I said, there are different ways to have approached this material, but I think the way that Tiernauer does it feels very complete. It feels like there's a beginning, middle, and end that really kind of follows the friendship of Schrager and Rubell, who could not have been more different. Like, you know, Rubell was very outgoing and very gay, and Schrager is, you know, very straight and very, you know, kind of buttoned down in a way. And just the two of them, you know, kind of being in the right place at the right time, and what Studio 54 sort of said about, you know, society and that kind of thing at the time. I think all this comes through in a really interesting way, and certainly footage I'd never seen before. So yeah, it's, if you're a fan of disco, if you're interested in kind of, you know, New York nightlife, or just sort of, you know, the cultural history of the U.S., you know, I think it's a really fascinating film.
Can you say, without giving too much away, why this place in this time? Why did it become such a phenomenon of all the nightclubs in all the world?
You know, they talk about different things that they sort of innovated. You know, certainly a lot of it had to do with the exclusivity of it all. Like, you know, they would stand out front and sort of pick, like, you can come in, you can come in, you can't, you can't, you can't. And so that made it, you know, getting in made you a star in a way, you know. And I think that was sort of the thing, was, you know, this notion of this unattainable, you know, little treat for people. And so made more people want to clamor to get in.
And it was pre-AIDS New York.
Yes. And as the demise of Studio 54, you know, you can sort of see that that's sort of on the horizon. Like, you know, it's sort of like how when people talk about the death of John Belushi as being sort of like the wake-up call that, oh yeah, cocaine is bad, y'all. You know, that's happening around then. But also, yeah, AIDS was just about to rear its ugly head. And so it definitely was a phenomenon of its moment, and it was a moment that was about to end. You know, also, of course, the whole disco sucks backlash.
Right. The Reagan era is coming.
Exactly, you know, because white straight guys could not tolerate a movement that, you know, was good for gays, women, and people of color, you mm-hmm. know.
So it looks fun. So you're not giving it a number.
I'm not giving it a number because, we screened both Studio 54 and Scotty at Outfest this year, where I'm a programmer, and I interviewed Matt Tiernauer a couple of times. But it's a terrific movie. I very highly recommend it. People should check it out.
Cool. Where can people find it? Is it streaming?
It's opening theatrically in New York and L.A., maybe beyond that. It's not streaming yet, but it was produced by A&E, so I imagine it's going mm-hmm. to air on A&E at some point, but it is opening theatrically.
It's at 95% on the tomato meter. It's a really good week, you guys, except for Venom.
Uh-huh.
All the movies we were talking about are really high, like 90s to 100 on the tomato meter.
And I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but also premiering on Friday on Netflix is Tamara Jenkins' new movie, Private Life.
It's supposed to be great.
Which I'm hearing really great things about. Paul Giamatti and Catherine Hahn, and people are saying their performances are extraordinary.
Our good friend Matt Singer tweeted about it today, saying it's his favorite movie of the year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
well, I'm definitely going to watch that.
Maybe we'll catch up with that next week. Also next week, real fast, let's do a recap. We talked about A Star Is Born, which we loved. Mm-hmm. Venom, which we did not love. Alonzo and I were both,
varying degrees.
Yes. Alonzo and I both loved The Hate U Give. And we both recommend, or each individually mm-hmm. recommend Free Solo and Studio 54. Next week is another biggie. We're in award season.
Ooh, yeah.
First Man is next week, mm-hmm. as well as Beautiful Boy, Bad Times at the El Royale, I don't know if Goosebumps 2 is screening. Maybe it is.
Oh, I haven't heard anything yet.
There is another Goosebumps movie. It's not The House with a Clock in Its Walls. It's very similar. So we've got another big week for you next week. Thank you all for sticking around with us. Matt, if Matt were here, he would also thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, go to moviephone.com and see what Matt's up to. I'm at A. Duraldi on Twitter, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E. Check out my podcast, Linoleum Knife, which I co-host with my husband, Dave White. It's at, you know, in all the places where you get podcasts. And we're actually going to do a standalone Star is Born episode and really go deep into the history of all of the different versions, including the new one. And you can read my reviews at therap.com, T-H-E-W-R-A-P.
Fun. Check them out. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.